Hello and welcome to Think Ahead, a London Business School podcast, which offers evidence-based discussions and insights to help you navigate big business issues. I'm Julian Birkinshaw, Professor of Strategy and Entrepreneurship and Vice Dean at London Business School, as well as the host of our Think Ahead podcast series. We recently held a thought-provoking discussion on issues and uncertainties in the global economy, where LBS faculty came together for this wide-ranging conversation. The panel explored the multiple interconnected pressures on the global economy, from war and climate change to inflation and supply chain disruption, looking at how these issues may impact the outlook for business. They also discussed the various challenges and opportunities for business in the current global economic landscape. The esteemed panel included four professors from London Business School: Richard Portis, Lucrezia Reichlin, Jeremy Gallien, and Nikos Sava, and was moderated by Isha Nelson, business and economics reporter at the New York Times. You can listen to the podcast now.
Welcome, everyone. I first would like to say thank you for leaving the beautiful weather outside and coming in to join us. I promise we will absolutely make it worth your while. So as the title of this session says, we're talking about issues and uncertainties in the global economy. We only have about an hour this afternoon, and there are way too many to get through in that small amount of time. So we're just going to pick a select few to talk about and discuss, and hopefully also take away some of the opportunities that are part of dealing with some of these challenges. And anyway, we don't want to depress you all too much on a Friday afternoon. So I'm going to ask each of my esteemed panelists here to just introduce the topic that they're going to be talking about a little bit more in the Q&A session afterwards. So, Lucrezia, I'm going to ask you to begin by introducing the topic you'll be talking about today as one of the major issues facing the global economy.
Thank you very much, and good afternoon, everybody. So I will talk about inflation and monetary policy. You know that inflation is back, at least for the moment, and central banks are pursuing the sharpest tightening that we have seen since the Second World War. And I think it's important to appreciate this fact that the tightening, we hadn't seen anything like that in many, many years. So the question is, are they doing too much or are they doing too little? Or better, for, you know, since we are talking about uncertainty this afternoon, what are the risks of doing too much or the risk to do too little? So I think to answer that question, I just want to have a few initial observations. The first of all is we should ask ourselves what kind of shocks, why all of a sudden we have seen inflation. And there is a debate out there, demand, supply, fiscal policy, whatever. So my view is that if we talk especially about Europe, this is mostly a supply-driven shock. And I'm talking here about energy and supply chains. And this means when we talk about energy, that since European citizens are not producers of energy, are net importers of energy, that shock has made all of us poorer. This is not the case for the US because they are net exporters. However, for both the Eurozone and Europe in general and the US, we have seen a very lots of change in relative prices. And changes in relative prices creates a dynamic of inflation, which is very difficult to understand. So that, first energy goes up and then manufacturing prices go up because they're direct users of energy, and then services because they're user of manufacturing products and so on and so forth. That's a chain. We create a persistence which central banks have very hard time to understand. Now, the other The characteristic of this inflation is that inflation expectations have been stable. And this is very different from the inflation of the 70s, that only Richard and I were there when that happened, okay? But we remember that. So with that background, then we can ask, okay, where are we now after, more than a year of tightening? And my view is that we have tightened enough. And I think it would be dangerous to tighten more. My calculation on how much, how much tightening there is 110 basis points for the US, more than a neutral situation, and about 50 basis points for the Eurozone above neutral situations. Having said that, I think that a discussion about inflation should also take a more long-term view. Mm-hmm. And on the long term, there are maybe factors that will drive inflation on average to be, you know, higher than in the past. And these have to do with the need of public and private investment that we will see in the next decades as a consequence of the many risks the economy is facing, especially climate change.
Thank you so much. Great. Richard, can I ask you to introduce your topic?
Yes, crypto. The good news is that crypto is not a threat to the financial system. I spent the past year and a half chairing a task force, European task force, that just produced a report addressing precisely this question, crypto and financial stability. And I can say with some confidence that right now, crypto is not a threat to financial stability. The bad news is multiple. There's no obvious, to me, there's no obvious use case for crypto, first. Second, if you wanted to use, think about money, crypto as money, forget it. It's not money. It doesn't perform, couldn't perform the same functions as money, being a unit of account, store of value, medium of exchange, very efficiently. And the so-called stable coins are simply so-called stable coins. Some of you will know that Tether, for example, mm-hmm. one of the best known, broke its peg last year once, and it just broken its peg recently, past 4 days. Tether is not as dramatically below one as it was a year ago for a while, but it's been 4 days now that it's been distinctly below its peg. And there are other stable coins, so-called stable coins, that have shown they're not stable either. But this is great. It's decentralized. You don't need to trust anybody, right? Trust the code. Excuse me. Typically, crypto transactions have to go through exchanges of one sort or another. And even to convert crypto into fiat money through banks. Well, look at what happened to the two banks that specialized in crypto. They went down, okay? Signature and Silvergate. And as for the exchanges, well, there's FTX, yes. Coinbase is now being sued by the United States. Binance is now being sued by the United States. I don't think I want to deal with them anyway. And then the question comes, what is it that we can do about this? What should the regulators do to deal with those issues, with the bad news? And the answer there is very different in different jurisdictions. Europe now has entering into force this year a very detailed markets and crypto assets set of regulations, okay, meant for consumer and investor protection. The US has no such thing and is not likely to have any such thing for quite some time. So that leaves the SEC free to do what the SEC wants to do, which is effectively kill off crypto. And they're doing a fairly good job of it. So that's the two places. UK is somewhere in the middle, but Rishi Sunak said himself, he was thrilled that Andreessen Horowitz is going to set up their big crypto office, European crypto office, here in London. Isn't that wonderful? I don't think it's wonderful, but we can talk about that. France, we in the UK didn't let Binance register here because people could see there are problems with that outfit. France welcomed them with open arms. They're now not quite so sure that that was a great thing to do. So Singapore initially was very friendly, and then in September of last year decided they didn't want to be friendly after all. Hong Kong, on the other hand, is proving to be super friendly right now, or trying to be super friendly. So you have very different approaches across the globe to crypto. I know which side I'm on.
Wonderful. Hey, don't trust the humans, trust the code. Nicholas, I think this brings us nicely to you.
Excellent, because the topic I've chosen to talk about is all about coding and generative AI. So you're surprised. So who's using, who has ever used ChatGPT or Bing or one of the other? Most of you? Who's using it every day? Okay, a few of you. Okay, good. Did you know that ChatGPT, the technology behind it, existed for at least 5 years? I've been using it in my classrooms at LBS for at least 2 years, and nobody cared, and now you all do? So what has changed? I think, there were two innovations. So the first was that these models became a lot larger in the last year or so. And sort of by becoming a lot larger, they developed capabilities that surprised many industry observers, certainly me, and I think also, to be honest, their developers. So size seems to matter in this case, and size enables these codes to become more sophisticated, to generate output, which is text or images or video these days, that's close to the quality of that produced by humans. The second thing that happened also sort of about 9 months ago was that OpenAI created this wrapper around ChatGPT, sort of which made it sort of available to anybody with an internet browser and very nice.
The rest of us could join you, basically.
The rest of us, could, without needing to code, without needing to use any complex interface, you could use it. Why is this important? Because the ability to create sort of knowledge, text that's at human level quality, is having the potential to automate tasks that are difficult to codify, tasks that are related to creativity, tasks that are related to the knowledge-based work that I'm guessing most of us are engaged with. So, and these were exactly the tasks that were very difficult to automate in the past. So this is sort of, a new era we're living in, where it's possible to now start automating knowledge-based work. So because this is a panel about evidence, I wanted to spend a few minutes talking about what the evidence tells us about how good these models are in automating knowledge-based work. There are 4 studies that I think passed the sort of, the scientific threshold of being considered worthy to mention in this panel. The first one looked at knowledge-based workers. These are mid-level professionals and their ability to write memos and emails. And what the study found is that compared to those that didn't have access to ChatGPT, those that did were able to do their work 37% faster, and they were rated as doing their work a little bit better than those that didn't have access to ChatGPT. Now, can you imagine, when was it the last time that knowledge-based work had a 37% productivity boost? Mm-hmm. Never. So another study looked at computer coders, and those that had access to ChatGPT were able to complete coding tasks faster, and they said they were more satisfied with their work because they spent less time getting stuck on problems and more time on the creative part of coding. A study looked at how ChatGPT was giving advice to patients and compared it to the advice doctors were giving to patients. And a panel of experts preferred the advice of ChatGPT to the advice of human doctors 79% of the time. And patients found the advice given by ChatGPT as more empathetic. So you know we're in trouble if computers are faster, slightly better quality, and more empathetic than us. And let me just finish with one observation. Some of the studies also looked at who benefits from the use of ChatGPT, which workers benefit the most. And by and large, the findings are that the least experienced workers, the workers that perform kind of, less well compared to sort of, the average or the most experienced workers, they are those that perform, their performance increases the most by using ChatGPT. So in a sense, you can think of ChatGPT as the great equalizer in terms of performance. And all of these are going to have sort of tremendous implications. And I'm not sure what all of these implications are, but I'm sure for one thing that they're going to increase uncertainty, which is the theme of the panel.
Thank you so much. Jeremy, can I ask you just to briefly introduce your topic as well?
The first question I'm asking myself is, why am I here? I sort of been teaching supply chain management for a long time now. This is my field where I do research. And so why am I here? I'll do it like Richard. Bad news. It's probably not a streak of bad luck. So COVID, Brexit, Ukraine, if you're here in the UK, some disruptions, it's not, and there's reasons why I'm here, it's not a streak of bad luck. Sort of climate change, weather disruptions, epidemics, more people living in the world, those people travel more, communicate more, and so on. Geopolitics, of course, but you also have globalization as a general trend, increasing ever, and market demands. The more we all want customized products, we want them cheaper. There's more competition. We want a more larger selection of these products. And what does that mean in terms of the supply chains that are required in order to satisfy this market? They're broader, more widespread, more disseminated, and more exposed to this trend of more and more disruptions in the supply chain. Okay, so that's That's why it's, I have my seat here in this high-flying panel. That's the bad news, some of the bad news. I'm sparing some of it in the spirit of looking forward to the weekend. Good news, though. The good news is that there's lots of opportunities relative to what firms are doing. There's been a lot of work thinking through what's best practice. How should companies, organizations respond to these increasing threats? Okay, and there's very well known. They're not easy to do, but they're well identified type of ideas and concepts and tools that can be applied. I'd say the first one is sort of pretty well established. It's a sort of move from firefighting and becoming a good crisis manager to sort of looking at it as a strategy much more in advance and really looking at assessment, prevention, mitigation, and sort of action that companies can do in these areas. So that's the first one. The second one is the realization that, risk management for many of us in companies, it means these risk registers, okay, ERM, risk registers. I bet most of you, have been involved in those. So you basically identify risk and think of risk as events, okay? A cyber attack, a fire, an earthquake, a tornado, and so on. And so for each of these events, what's the probability, what's the impact, and what should we plan to do in case that hits? And that's useful, in particular, for contingency planning for the high probability, high impact events. But sort of the emerging paradigm that's sort of been proven to be much better is to not focus on all of these events. I mean, who forecasted that the boat was going to block the Suez Canal? Who forecasted that there was going to be an Icelandic volcano bringing down the European airspace? And so on and so forth. So the opportunity is to think instead of supply chains as assets, facilities, products, suppliers, transportation links. And for each of these assets, not think of the specific event that could disrupt them, but think of what would be the consequences and the actions that would be dictated by this particular asset being taken out. Okay, so that's the first idea. The second idea is using data, the raw kind of data, which is why those topics are obviously related. And the right kind of data here is the data that allows many people in organizations to make the right decision. It's very systemic. Resilience is dictated by what product you make, how you make them, where you have your suppliers, where you put your facilities, how you deal with your contract suppliers, where you do dual supply. And all of these decisions are made by pretty much everywhere in organizations. So you need the data that allows them to make these right decisions, taking into account risk. And there's at least concepts are there for doing this, revenue at risk, profit at risk. It's almost like a company that has to build up a bit of an insurance capability. So good news, there's tools that are appropriate for this. Other opportunity to be good at resilience, sort of mapping out disruptions, is first, there's a number of anecdotes, there's a study by Hengritz and Signals saying it does have a lasting impact on performance. Companies that are good at doing this, responding, planning to disruptions, have a sustainable, long-lasting advantage on the market. And then the other good news, if you wish, is that you gain strategic advantage. And if you become good at doing this, you also become good at doing other things, like knowing supply chain transparency. Who are your suppliers? Your suppliers, what data do you have about them? And it's also aligned, synergistic, with sustainability. Okay, the kind of relationship, tools, mapping, data you need. Well, if you start having to worry about your supplier, extended responsibility in the supply chain, for example, it's the same kind of data that you need to make the decisions about making your supply chain resilient in the first place. If you're good at resilience, there's lots of synergies with sustainability as well as, of course, running your operation in a more transparent way for your customers to see. Okay,
Thank you. They're all very naughty and spoke for much longer than I told them to. So now we're going to whiz through a bunch of questions in much more detail. There's amazing ways to kind of set us off. Look, actually, I'm going to come back to you and your question, inflation. To me, it feels like we're in a bit of a new phase with the inflation, I'm going to say issue, problem, question, where inflation has come down quite far from its peak in the US for certain, in Eurozone, unfortunately, a little bit less here in the UK. And a lot of policymakers imply to me that, you know, that was the easy bit. A lot of that was based, especially in Europe, on what's going on with the energy markets, and that's in a better state. So now the difficult bit is getting actually to this 2% medium-term target in all these places. I'm wondering, you said there that you felt actually that central banks had tightened enough. Do you feel that actually this is being a little bit dramatic, and maybe it's not the difficult part? How do you assess this next bit they have to do, and why, and just a little bit more detail on why exactly you think they could be done?
Yes, my view is that because this is the shock which comes with a lot of changes in relative prices, and that has originated from energy and disruption of supply chains, is absolutely to be expected that when energy goes down, headline inflation goes down very rapidly. And in fact, it has gone down more rapidly than at the beginning of the 80s when we had a similar type of shock. And this is, you know, our memory. But it is also to be expected that the underlying inflation, what is called core inflation, which is mostly service, would go down, has picked up later, but would go down much more slowly. So in my calculation, okay, so evidence-based, when we look at the past for both the US and the Eurozone, the delay from the first shock until core inflation goes back to the initial conditions is about 60 months. Mm-hmm. So we are within the norm. I must say that my view is not the mainstream view.
I may
be wrong, okay? So, but this is, I've just written a report in which I've been trying to argue this point.
Well, no, it's an interesting one. I think part of the challenge we face is that central bankers have become a little bit more nervous about their forecasts. You know, they've kind of apologized for the fact that they underestimated inflation. So even with the analysis you've done, they might not be so willing to sit on their hands and wait. And as we go into the summer, I think it's going to be interesting. You know, we saw the ECB raising rates yesterday, saying they were going to do more. The day before the ECB the Fed pausing, and next week, probably the Bank of England going ahead. How do companies react to this uncertainty this summer, where it's going to be less clear what each central bank decides to do?
Yeah, I think what you said is right. I think that, I mean, what people have picked up is that there is a little bit of confusion and uncertainty from the side of central bankers. It is to be understood because the situation is totally, you know, new to a certain extent, and that so monetary policy has become more an exercise of risk management, like Jeremy was saying. So it is really about balancing this risk. But the thing that I find incredibly surprising is that if you look at the expectations of companies and the professional forecasters, they are quite stable around the 2% target if you look at the medium term, which is 2 to 3 years. Mm. And so in a way, that credibility has not been lost, which one, you know, maybe will be lost, you know, because, you know, the communication is not ideal. I mean, both Lagarde and Powell gave an impression of not exactly knowing what was going to happen next, data-driven. This is the message that they keep on giving. But accurate expectations are quite anchored. Now, if expectations are anchored, that means that there is sort of a little bit of a luxury to go a bit slower. Remember that monetary policy acts with a lag of about 2 years. So we are only now seeing the effect of the tightening that has been already implemented, especially in the credit markets, where, you know, the numbers for credit conditions, loan demands have deteriorated quite fast, both in Europe and in the US.
Absolutely. So how should companies respond to this period of higher interest rates that will probably last a while, this lagged effect where we're only actually starting to experience the tighter financing conditions? What are those implications when it comes to investment, comes to other decisions that our audience should be thinking about?
Well, you know, when Paul Volcker, who is a hero, former president of the Federal Reserve, and is a hero because he tamed that inflation of the early 80s, when he was asked, how did you manage to tame inflation? He said, well, I created a few banking crises. And, you know, this is probably what we're going to see. So we are going to see that, you know, some weakness in the financial market. Of course, the mortgage market is the first to be hit. In the UK, there will be, you know, a lot of mortgage holders that will have to roll over, you know, their loans. And so this is these people are going to be hit, okay? So this is typically, you know, the first people who will be hit. Eventually, this will have an effect in consumption. Now, consumption has been very weak in the Eurozone, not so much in the UK. So this is a difference. But, you know, the numbers have been surprising, you know, on the upside so far. But now we see increasingly some weakness in the, you know, in the credit market, especially. OK, so that's what you see.
Basically, some
not so much in the labor market. This has been also the big puzzle that central bankers have been confronted to, because normally central bankers think, well, there is first unemployment, and then, you know, when you start tightening, the first effect is on the labor market. But partly because of the big changes in behavior in the labor market post-COVID, we have seen that unemployment has been quite low. And so the main channel of inflation has not really been the labor market.
Just to make sure I understand your point, that after the pandemic, and it was so hard to hire people again, companies have become much more resistant to letting people off now because
that's
they don't want to go through that all over again.
And then there have been in the US, and not so much in the Eurozone, the great resignation. So a lot of people have decided to stay home or to go part-time. So now this is gradually changing, but, you know, post-COVID, that was something that...
Thank you. Yeah. Richard, I can't help but pull you in to talk about banking crises, and we'll blame the credit who brought them up. But, you know, are we out of the woods yet? When we spoke a couple of months ago, we were sitting around the table just as Credit Suisse was being bought by UBS, Silicon Valley Bank had collapsed. It felt like we were right in the middle of a banking crisis. I've decided to become quite relaxed about it, but maybe I shouldn't be.
No, I don't think the banking crisis is over at all. Not in the United States, at least. Europe's a different story. European banks are pretty well capitalized and are not stuffed with low interest rate, low yielding assets as the American banks are. And that's the real problem. The problem here, I might disagree slightly with Lucrezia, the problem there is not a mortgage market problem at all, not yet anyway. The problem is that the banks, in the period of very low rates, took on a lot of very low-yielding assets, whether they be long-term securities or long-term loans, at low rates, okay? Then rates go up, and guess what? What happens to your net interest margin? What happens to your depositors? Your depositors are getting virtually nothing on their deposits, but all of a sudden, now they've got an alternative. They can go to a money market fund that's going to pay 3%, 4%, 5%, say. And so what do you do as a bank? You've got to raise your deposit rates on deposits in order to stop the outflow. And that is a road to ruin. Long-term, not immediate, but what happens is, effectively, that the deposit franchise gets eroded and the banks, and we're talking particularly about the mid-range, mid-sized banks in the U.S., that I think are many of which are becoming zombies.
Great, something to look forward to then. But while all this is happening in the U.S., how much should we in Europe be worried about spillovers from that? Because you can't quite, you know, there's an Atlantic Ocean, but I don't think that's always enough.
Not a lot. No, I don't think, as I say, I don't think it's a big threat to the European banking system. We had the Credit Suisse story, but that was really an exception. Very, very bad regulation and a sequence of mistakes that go over a whole, you know, a long period that led this bank to effectively to failure. But it wasn't a matter of the changing interest rate environment. That bank was effectively insolvent by the autumn of last year. They lost one third of their entire deposit base in 3 months, the last quarter of 2022. You can't live very long that way.
Okay. I'm going to move us on to a pretty wide-ranging conversation about tech. And Nikos, I want to ask you, you know, McKinsey says generative AI is set to add up to $4.4 trillion of value to the global economy annually, as it automates up to half of all work between 2030 and 2060. Now, others are saying that AI could destroy humanity. Which one is more likely?
Both.
Oh, great.
the implications of ChatGPT to the economy, the short-term implications, if you like. And I think their McKinsey study, you know, is spot on. So a lot of the work is going to be automated, and initially it's going to be more repetitive, more menial tasks, but increasingly it's going to be more creative tasks. And whenever you have large productivity gains, I mean, two things happen. First, you need fewer people to complete the same amount of work, but also the cost of the work goes down, and therefore work that wasn't economical to do before becomes profitable to do. So the work expands, and typically in previous shocks, the latter effect dominated. So we didn't see huge drops in employment after previous shocks like the internet, for example. But that's not to say that we shouldn't worry about this, because there might be issues with inequality, issues with more of the rents going towards capital rather than workers, and we need to be prepared, and we need to not repeat the same mistakes that we have in the past. So that's on the economic side. Now, more on the existential side, there's two types of worries. The first worry is that bad actors might use this technology for certain purposes that are not desirable. For example, the cost of writing fake stories that are customized to the interests of specific groups have come down dramatically. So perhaps it would be easier to create campaigns with fake news to try to manipulate democracy, elections, and so forth. More seriously, perhaps, the studies that suggest that you can use ChatGPT to get information as to how to create a pathogen that can create a pandemic, and with detailed instructions as to how to do this and where to order the material and what companies to order them from that are less likely to scrutinize your orders.
Lovely.
We're just kind of scared.
Yeah, I'm scared.
And so we need to, again, start thinking about how do we regulate this? How do we make it more difficult for people to misuse this technology? And then there's a third category, which is even more existential, if you like, which is this comes from the fact that technology has improved immensely in the last year. So exponential improvement. So if it continues, it's a big if. There's very good reasons to believe that it might not. But if it continues, then we might find ourselves with having artificial intelligence that's so much better than human intelligence that can continue improving on itself, by itself. And then people talk about the end of human domination on the planet. And we're going to have this alien technology that we have to compete with, or at least contend with. And that's something to worry about.
Yeah, great. well, we will ponder that. This week was an interesting week, though, in terms of AI regulation.
Yeah.
The European Parliament passed its draft law, which some people have said is kind of maybe going to set the standard, or at least is something that other countries can look to. I'm kind of curious if you could just talk us through a little bit about where some different locations stand at the moment in terms of regulation, in terms of how you tackle both getting the economic advantages out, while also we know that they're looking at how do we make things like ChatGPT more transparent, how do we curtail the use of facial recognition software, and how do we decide when and we should and shouldn't use it, and all these really complicated ethical privacy questions. What's the landscape at the moment?
I mean, you're right, it's a complicated question, and at the heart of it, the fundamental trade-off of regulation is what it usually is. So on one hand, you want to protect consumers from
alien AI race taking over.
From an alien AI, from bad humans using the technology in a nefarious manner, or even from alien technology. But on the other hand, you don't want to stifle innovation. Okay, so you want to get the benefits, but you want to at the same time minimize the harm. So the regulation is really trying to identify where the harms might be coming from, and at least in the short term, and try to mitigate some. Europe is on the forefront of regulation. It has been with GDPR. Whether this has been effective or not, we can debate that. In some dimensions, it has been more effective than others. But other jurisdictions like the UK view this as an opportunity to allow companies to develop faster with less regulatory oversight, hoping that this will generate an advantage in the long run. But I am a little worried that the UK is a little too relaxed about AI. But at the same time, I mean, the current technology, the amount of regulation we need to do on the current technology, I think is is relatively light. It's not as dangerous as people think it is. And it's not a foregone conclusion that we're going to have sort of, you know, general AI that's going to be so much better than humans in the very near future. So right now, I think the right approach is to sort of monitor where the harms are coming from, be prepared to act if it seems like sort of we're seeing damage being generated. But this is so new, so I think it would be premature to start regulating with very specific frameworks at this stage.
What about, you know, companies now that, you know, they aren't AI companies, but they want to take advantage of what's out there? I'm just kind of curious about, where do you start? Where do you begin? What kind of opportunities are there that people can access today and not necessarily have to keep waiting for kind of more advances?
So there's actually a lot of opportunities to integrate generative AI in sort of, you know, existing workflows. There are some problems to be overcome. So I know that a lot of banks, for example, and financial institutions in the UK have banned the use of generative AI within their systems. And the fear there is sort of data security. Mm-hmm. So if you have employees putting in customers' information and asking sort of ChatGPT to write an email to the customer, I mean, that's data, that's information that's leaving the company systems and going sort of, you know, out and shared in the internet. So the first challenge is to create sort of systems that exist within the firewalls of a company, so to safeguard information. And this is happening, but we are maybe 6 months away from this sort of being rolled out. And the second, so this is the infrastructure. So you need to get the infrastructure right. And the second thing you need to start doing is you need to start sort of examining sort of processes and re-engineering processes so that parts that can be that can benefit from a productivity booster from ChatGPT can sort of, you know, benefit from it. And then the third thing is to sort of, you know, put safeguards and guardrails because this technology is not perfect. It's sort of, you know, immature, and you want to sort of catch the instances where the technology is kind of failing to have the desirable impact. So I think these three parts.
Great. Yeah, absolutely. Let's move on to crypto, which is always a joyful roller coaster to be on. You know, you already told us about some of the failures, but I just wanted to go back to some of the use cases now. You know, what are the ways in which crypto, decentralized finance, can be used present tense, not future tense?
I don't think there is a use case. I don't think there's a demonstrated use case at all. The transactions with these instruments are costly. Mm-hmm. They're not so fast. I can transfer money across borders, actually, now, through my own bank, very quickly. I don't need to use crypto and go through the blockchain and spend, actually, a substantial fee in doing so. So, you know, if anybody can show me, you're all entitled to come up with one, and some of you doubtless own crypto. I should have asked at the beginning.
We can ask now. Show of hands.
Now.
No one willing to
admit? Oh, I don't believe that.
Come on.
Come on.
Two hands in the top.
You are statistical, completely outlier.
Yeah, I don't believe you.
I just took a group of students to Frankfurt in Paris, and at one point spoke to an alumni group, the alumni club in Paris, and they wanted to talk about crypto. And I asked them, you know, about a quarter to a third, I would say, of that group are own crypto. Nothing, you know, there's nothing wrong with it. You know, if you want to gamble, that's fine. It's gambling. Gambling is perfectly respectable, right? I have nothing against gambling, but that's what it is. So if somebody can give me a convincing use case that doesn't involve money laundering, doesn't involve regulatory arbitrage, and doesn't involve fraud of any sort, then okay, I'm ready to listen, but I haven't seen it.
Okay. What about, I'm just curious about then the things that you described as being failures, you know, the exchanges that have collapsed, stablecoins, are they like real death blows to this industry, or in a couple of years' time, are we going to be having a similar conversation?
There was an interesting piece in the FT today by their crypto correspondent, who just came back from a crypto conference in Amsterdam and said the mood was very downbeat, right? And that's partly because not just of FTX, right? But the problems with a number of those.
Yeah.
You've got these
outfits that are crypto asset service providers, we CASPs, and they commingle functions that you would not allow a traditional financial institution, an institution in the standard financial system to do, right? To hold, you know, hold deposits on for depositors, not just to hold deposits, to lend, to act as an exchange, the London Stock Exchange doing lending, excuse me, right? This is not such a good idea. And that's what you have in the crypto space. So I think that that those institutions, which turn out, I mean, as I say, this is supposed to be decentralized finance, and yet a lot of it is going through these exchanges, which have turned out to be, in some cases, just purely fraudulent. And it's not just FTX, Gemini. There's this whole story. I keep on getting mixed up between Gemini and Genesis. One owes the other a lot of money, right? And it hasn't got it. Okay? And so that means that depositors are out, as it stands right now, about $1 billion worth of whatever it is that them is worth of. Okay? This is not good, and that's where we are. Right?
But if there's, you know, as you said at the start there, no threat to financial stability, is the issue here that it's not entirely contained, right? That there are all these depositors out there without access to money, that the industry doesn't completely go away. Is that why we talk about it so much?
Well, there is a case for consumer and investor protection. That's what the European Union has decided to do. One of my good friends and colleagues, and who served on the task force that I was heading, very distinguished professor of finance, says, let it burn, right? Don't regulate it. Don't legitimize it by regulating it, okay? You just let it implode. It'll implode. People will get hurt on the way, that's for sure. But, you know, tant pis. Stuff happens, yeah? And it, if it's gambling, you win a few, lose a few. And that, I think, that is really the difference right now between Europe, which is taking this detailed regulatory approach. The UK hasn't really decided there's some conflict, if those of you who are familiar with UK financial markets and so forth. In this case, there's a clear conflict between the Bank of England and their views on these issues and the Treasury or the ministers, okay? I wouldn't speak for the civil servants in the Treasury, but ministers are, as I said, including the Prime Minister, we want to be a center for financial innovation. So we want, you know, we want to be very friendly to crypto. The Bank of England says, well, you know, we are sort of familiar with some of these problems, and we've studied these problems here. This is not necessarily such a great idea. And I think that's where we're at.
They might just run down the clock to the next election, who knows? Let me ask Jeremy, if we could talk about supply chains a little bit here, because so I cover central banking mostly, and supply chains became, you know, all they talked about for a while there during the pandemic. But it was mostly this idea of supply chain bottlenecks, that these are kind of short-term-ish issues that were very much tied to the pandemic, and that now they're easing, they say with their fingers crossed, and inflation will improve, etc. But I feel like you're speaking of something bigger, something that's absolutely not, you know, transitory, more that supply chains have been disrupted for larger issues. I'm wondering if this is this geopolitical, is this extreme weather, conflict, all these things. Just take us back a little step in terms of like what those disruptions are that you think are the most serious, that aren't, you know, that won't ease, that can't just be, you can't just wait them out.
So yeah, recently we've had some disruptions that we would led to hope would be sort of transient bad luck. But when you step back, there's been a lot of the disruptions are hitting companies, so weather-related, fires, floods, hurricanes. A lot of those things are known to be linked to climate change. So they're not, and it's been sort of measured. It's more and more, and they also have more and more damaging impact. There's even sort of COVID. Obviously, it's very unprecedented in history, the extent of it, to which it disrupted everything, but the underlying reasons that are creating pandemic are relying, driven by how many people are on the planet and how many, how much exchange there is between them. And that is a steady increase as well. So the extent to which sort of small localized epidemics before can really spread out is really increasing as well. There's a back and forth, and it's not clear. I mean, it's a choice. How you design a supply chain? Do you buy your things local or halfway around the globe? Sort of cheapest, total landed cost, lots of transport, lots of intermediaries, a lot of arbitrage of labor costs and transportation costs and so on. It's going to take a while before the world is flat with respect to these differentials in costs. And the economic benefits, financial benefits associated with cutting purchase costs, cutting the total landed cost, are enormous. Because you're just sort of going right to the bottom line when you cut purchasing. So you've got this. So these are really strong, powerful incentives to expose supply chain through the design decisions that are made to this increasing trend of disruption. So yeah, no, it's sorry for the bad news, but that bit is definitely bad news. It's not just COVID. It's not just Brexit. It's been really going on for a long time. And of course, what we experience of it, the exact disruptions happening in a given year, at that scale, yeah, we can be lucky. We can be unlucky. Companies can be lucky or unlucky. But if you're sort of looking on a 5, 10, 15 years horizon, it's very clear. It's not going away.
You mentioned extreme weather, obviously linked to climate change. I was just thinking about the way supply chains are going to have to change because of climate change, whether it's location of where you are and the rest of your supply chain, whether that's trying to reduce emissions in line with transition plans that more and more companies are being asked to produce, or whether that's to take advantage of policy like the US Inflation Reduction Act. You mentioned all of these other things that are going to last for a really long time, and then you pile on all this other stuff. If I'm in charge of a company's supply chain, I'm sitting there going, this is absolutely loads to take on and to consider. And some of these things feel like they're in conflict to each other. So, I mean, how do you think through some of these challenges and kind of come up with a resilient process?
So that's why I think it is an opportunity. Mm-hmm. And it's also an opportunity that is linked to being more sustainable. And that's when at the end of it, if you really think deeply about it, what is the difference between being more resilient and being more sustainable? You know, you just use resilience in context of resisting to supply chain disruptions, whereas being more sustainable, it's more in the context of social, environmental sustainability. But in both cases, you affect resilience, sustainability by all of these really large numbers of decisions that companies make, sort of designing the product, what material you put it in, who you buy it from, where are the facilities that make them, how do you transport them around? And there's a lot of these trade-offs that companies are doing, both in the case of sustainability as in the case of resilience. Because, yeah, if I look at the price I'm getting now by buying from the cheapest vendor halfway around the world in China and then buying it 6 months before, shipping it through a container, cheap one, having intermediaries, stocking it, and so on, the total and the cost is going to be low. But what's the problem with it is that, and in many cases, these decisions are made. Mm-hmm. So really looking at efficiency-driven, TLC-driven decisions, and you don't care about maybe putting a more expensive material, which is not made in a region where there's hurricane or a region where there's sort of other kind of issues. And the opportunity is just like when you're assessing the trade-off between, okay, what's my emissions? What's my future impact on sustainability? Those things need to be financial, measured. And that's the opportunity. So we've installed the metrics that are going to allow these decentralized, all of these decentralized decision makers, product manager, purchasers, facility to inform these decisions and make the right trade-offs.
What I'm hearing is that there's just absolutely no easy answer to this because, you know, it can't just be you move everything closer or you go for price. It just seems like it's a much more complicated process than it maybe ever has been.
That's right. It's absolutely.
And you need to use data science and AI to do it better.
until it takes over. Right. There are huge amounts of challenges out there. How do we deal with higher interest rates for longer? What is the energy transition going to mean to volatility and long-term inflation? How do we ensure that all these gains in financial stability aren't undone by the other part, you know, the non-banking sectors of the economy? And how do we actually take advantage of all these questions around supply chains and use them well so that we don't all go into the supermarket and go, well, where is it? Not even where do we get it from, but why can't I find the thing we're actually looking for? So while that was, I guess, up and down emotionally, I would say, I do thank you all for joining us this afternoon. I really appreciate it. And thank you very much to our amazing panelists. Thank you.
Thanks, everyone, for listening. You've been listening to Think Ahead, brought to you by the editorial team at Think at London Business School. Follow us here for more episodes or find us on iTunes or Spotify. For more faculty research insights, go to london.edu/think. You can also sign up there for our free regular email newsletter to get updates on our latest publications direct to your inbox. And finally, don't forget to leave us a review or rating, which helps new listeners to find us.